This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Today I'll be talking with Daniel Craig about No Time to Die, his last James Bond film. But let's start here.
This is The Daily Show with Jon Stewart.
From the 2000 election to 9/11 and the Iraq War, right up until Donald Trump rode that escalator in the Republican campaign, The Daily Show with Jon Stewart often drove political conversation in this country. And Stewart's approach to political entertainment has proliferated all over, from John Oliver to Samantha Bee to Trevor Noah and more. His new show on Apple TV+, The Problem with Jon Stewart, is out now, and I spoke to Jon Stewart the other day at the New Yorker Festival. Now, where you been? What's your life been like? You cut out in 2015. There were a lot of disappointed people, but things come to an end.
Well, it was interesting. It was funny. When I went back to do the show that we're doing now for Apple, and the first day that we were there, you have an audience interaction generally before the show. You'll go out and you'll just say hello and you'll introduce yourself to everybody and kind of take some questions. And one of the questions somebody said to me is, you know, you've missed so much over these last, you know, 5 or 6 years. And I had to remind them, you know, I am alive. Like, it's not, I haven't been on television, but I too had to take precautions during COVID and suffered the stress and frustration and anger of the Trump years. You live all that.
But you knew what they're asking. You were a nightly presence for 15, 16 mm-hmm. years, and then right. and then not. How did your life change?
I did a tremendous amount of puttering. I have half a melon and then I jazzercise. It is a remarkable. Oddly enough, for me personally, the way I experienced life was fuller. I'd spent so much time singularly focused on The Daily Show, which is a very sort of eccentric process. And one that is, I don't want to say rote, because it certainly wasn't rote, but it was redundant.
But what you're describing is mm-hmm. is boredom in a sense or not?
No, I think that is in a sense, but it's also boredom based on narrowness of field.
Yeah.
I mean, there was a certain adolescent joy to that feeling of like, oh my God, I just got out of, you know, I've been looking through a cardboard tube.
You had time to think about the impact of your show. You're surrounded by people and fans all the time telling you about how you eviscerated or annihilated right. one thing or another, whether it was Fox News or...
I was a destroyer of worlds.
Yeah, exactly.
I was the Attila the Hun of topical comedy.
But I think it was the next to the last show you had, mm-hmm. you kind of came out and you showed... A montage of all these things that you'd supposedly destroyed, and there they all were. You said the world is demonstrably worse.
But, David, the interesting point about what you bring up is, and it's a great kind of discussion about perception and reality, because you said something in there that I thought kind of gets to it, which is you're surrounded by people, you know, who are... saying, you know, you annihilated or they're big fans. And I'm not. The truth is, I'm surrounded by staff and we're all working to make this product. And the internal barometer that you create with each other has to be strong enough to withstand this outside noise. But you can't think about that. You can only think about, in this room with these people, are we clear enough in our intention? Are we being funny enough? Is it smart? Is it relevant? Is this the best iteration of that idea? Are there other things that we could do to articulate it that's less strident? This is too didactic. Let's pull it down. Let's, you know, all those things are happening internally. So the external noise, to the best of your ability, has to be blocked out. It's still just television.
You left the show a year before, I don't know what the number of months was, before Trump. Trump is starting to appear, and you grew up in this area. Trump was a kind of a comic figure on the jokescape of New York. He was a, you know, on the cover of Spy magazine regularly. He was, you know, a kind of real estate bozo.
Right.
Were you taken by surprise as somebody from Jersey, from New York, who was very familiar with Trump, that he would connect as viscerally as he did with so much of the country? I mean, did that take you as much by surprise as nearly all of journalism?
I thought he disqualified himself at every turn. But for those of us who've been in New York, we probably saw, like, if nothing else, dude's resilient. Like, very few people can bankrupt that many things and still continue on with that kind of success. I think what was more, for me, more difficult was it affected kind of a larger, maybe more naive worldview on my part. And that was that I was raised on the ethos of the emperor's new clothes. That's what, you know, when you get into comedy or satire, I think there's a certain part of you that goes back to that old fable. And you're not prepared for the child saying, the emperor has no clothes. And you're not prepared for the crowd to go, you're the enemy of the people. You're fake news, and you run a pedophile ring out of a pizza place. You know, you're in that moment when naming the hypocrisy and the contradiction and the absurdity doesn't do anything, you really are left with a sense of, oh shit, now wait a minute. I didn't bring anything else. I'm not sure what to do now.
Did you have the temptation or even the vanity to think, you know, if I'd stayed longer, if I'd been here through 16, 17, 18, that the Daily Show would have been the effective means of pointing out the emperor has no clothes? No.
You know, there were a ton of really talented people doing the thing that I do and doing it every night and doing it really well. And it doesn't. What I'm saying is the lesson I learned from the Daily Show, that it's that cultural power isn't power. It has an effect. It's not nothing. But I think the narcissism of media, and I include myself in that, is that we believe that the halls of pontification are actually the halls of power. And they're not.
John, one more Trump question. In 4 years, Trump proved himself a colossal liar, an admirer of authoritarians, and his incompetence during the pandemic was what it was. And January 6th was supported by him and pretty self-evidently an attempt to illegally reverse a Democratic election. And yet he persists. He's quite likely to run in 2024, and I think to underestimate his chances seem incredibly foolish at this point.
Are people underestimating his chances?
I think people do. I think people think he's too old, he's finished, everybody's exhausted with him. How do you feel about it?
Oh, I think he's got a very good chance. You know, I remember the people saying, like, this is not normal. Corruption has been, if anything, he's done us a favor. I think he's peeled back the facade that our economy and that our government run on a higher-minded principle. And if we don't address that in a real way, then we are much more vulnerable to authoritarian takeover, which, by the way, is happening everywhere. And one of the reasons that it's happening is the overwhelming fire hose of stimulation and information that fires into people's synapses in a way that has never occurred before is disorienting. And in moments of disorientation, people look to the captain to say, follow me, I have the answer, and I will lead you forward. And you see it around the world.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about your new show. The first episode, which I thought was remarkable, was about a theme that's been very close to your heart for a long time. And the specifics of it was about the use of burn pits, where The military mm-hmm. disposes waste in an incredibly toxic way, and it's had terrible effects on the health of all kinds of soldiers. Now, and then right. it's followed up by an examination of the really woeful lack of health care that comes their way. You have an interview at the end of this, after a panel discussion with veterans, which was very moving. There's an interview with the Secretary of Veteran Affairs, Dennis McDonough, who had been right. chief of staff under Obama.
Right.
And he agrees with you that these burn pits are terrible and so on. But then he wants more proof, and which you find an incredibly, let's just say, insufficient answer. Right. You've often said you're not a journalist. How are you not a journalist in this program?
I mean, maybe that's what that is. I guess it's based on the idea that, having not really studied it, I don't know what does that mean. And my frustration with the media conversation in general is processes like the one that you're talking about, because what they're focused on is, what was that? You know, are you a journalist now, or are you still a comedian? And a lot of the stuff I read about it was that. It was simply sort of based on, like,
confusion.
Yeah. Like, what is it? And you just want to kind of at some point step back and go, like, I don't know, but I thought it was compelling and interesting and relevant.
Mm-hmm.
And so few of the people that talked about the show talked about what actually it was. And in some ways, a lot of it was gatekeeping on whether or not I should still be allowed. You're gatekeeping a shitty restaurant. Like, it's like being a bouncer at a Sizzlers. You know what I mean? Like, have you seen TV?
I won't hear anything bad,
like,
about Sizzlers.
As long as I'm not doing more episodes of Kitchen Nightmares, how is this not, like, it's such a, I just find the whole conversation so odd. Like, we have a show once a week on HBO that does a satirical look at issues. So what makes you think? And I'm like, how many fucking CSIs are there? Like, what are you talking about?
Let's talk about who's in that room. It's really interesting to me
yeah.
that your showrunner is not a comedy writer at all. She's a journalist from CBS, I think, in ABC.
Yeah. Brindata Carr, yeah.
Right. Tremendous. And you have a head writer who is a comedian, I think.
Chelsea Devantes, right. yeah.
How did you, that's a huge thing, how you mm-hmm. assembled the room. Who did you want in there? And how did you go about doing that? With what intent?
I wanted people who were really expert in what they did, but who were also open to translating a different intention. And if we threw them all into the room, and Chelsea, in terms of the writing staff, so there's two sides of it. There's the writing staff, and then there's more the production staff. There's, you know, video and research and all those other areas. It's built probably similar to a newsroom.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the bar of entry, especially for writing, is insane. And oftentimes, writing samples for shows are almost like hazing. Like, okay, here's what you're going to do. You're going to write 3 sample scripts. And then when you're done with the sample scripts, I'd like you to just pick and invent 8 new words. And I'd like them to be popularized. You know, it's fucking like they just come up with these insanely robust, like it's somehow, it's got to be an Ironman triathlon. And
yeah.
so Chelsea said, you know, let's create something that's doable. One page of jokes. Because here's the truth of it. We've been doing this a long time. It doesn't take me very long in reading somebody where I go, or
the other.
Oh, right.
John, the second episode is called Freedom, and it's about division in the country, especially where it comes to the pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
And it invokes everyone's favorite person, Adolf Hitler.
But I see the problem. You think the government taking public safety measures to combat COVID is like Hitler. And we think COVID is like Hitler. And so it looks like we got ourselves a good old-fashioned Hitler off. So once and for all, let's find out what's more Hitler. I believe you were supposed to chant that with me, so we're going to try that again. What's more Hitler? By the way, do you think that's how Hitler started? They really like chanting the name Hitler. All right, here's how. Shit's getting dark fast, isn't it?
What were you setting out to do in this episode?
If you were to boil it down to one thing, it's that their reluctance to go along with sacrifice oftentimes is painted as a virtue. So if wearing a mask is what Hitler did, and sort of the joke is like, well, you know, Hitler did institute certain mandates, but it's not what he was known for. You know, and we do a bit called What's More Hitler? COVID or the mask mandate? And it's kind of just feeling like, okay, body count wise, I'm going to say it's COVID. I think that's more Hitler than, you know, mask mandates. And so I think the thrust of the episode is, if we have a freedom that no longer is connected to meaning, then anything that happens can be viewed as oppression.
A lot of voices now, John, are yeah. Like Bill Maher, for example, when it comes mm-hmm. to the culture wars, he expresses his frustration over and over again. I can't say this. We're limited in saying that. We have to mm-hmm. wear a gag and this kind of expression. Comedians right. are talking all the time about, well, I feel I can't do this. I can't say that.
No.
How do you come down on this?
All the people who talk about cancel culture, here's a nice absurdity.
Okay.
People that talk about cancel culture never seem to shut the fuck up about it. Like, there's more speech now than ever before. It's not you can't say, it's that when you say it, look, the internet has democratized criticism. What do we do for a living? We talk shit. We criticize, we postulate, we opine, we make jokes, and now other people are having their say. And that's not cancel culture, that's relentlessness. We live in relentless culture. Look at what's happening with Chappelle right now. So many conservatives
This
now.
Is the critique of him about transgender jokes.
Yeah, or just his and leaving all that aside, what's interesting is to watch right-wing Twitter and the internet grab him and hold him up now and weaponize what he's going through and what he's doing as a way of further pushing their political. When, you know, we're free speech warriors just like Dave Chappelle. Right. What would happen if Dave took a knee at a football game? Still there?
Yeah.
No.
Still in the line. It always struck me throughout all the years of The Daily Show that there was also an innate optimism mm-hmm. to your view of things. Where resides your optimism?
In the resilience of the human species to move forward. I came of age in the late 60s and early 70s when the best people this country had to offer were all killed. And the Vietnam War raged. And the president of the United States was a liar, and it exposed certain realities of power structures. And so I don't look at today as uniquely flawed or uniquely troubling or uniquely, I look at it as all of the time periods that have come to pass. You know, my parents came of age in the Depression and World War II. So the greatest threat to our mental health, I think, is probably loss of perspective and nostalgia. Who knows what incredible inventions and progress and intelligence will spring forth from this shit show? But it will. And it will, and not in a linear fashion, and it may be down the road, and it may be, but it's kind of the point I'm always trying to make, which is we're complicated and dangerous and amazing and lovely and horrible. And all the things that we do to progress, oftentimes in unseen ways, come back to destroy. But there's always that, but that's not the intention. The intention is generally to better. And I've always believed that. Maybe naively so, but I always believe that. And again, don't confuse that with, and so I think we should just wait. Like,
but and how can we not be optimistic with Jeff Bezos in space, as you've featured on the show?
He's a wonderful man. You know what I always feel like saying to him when, if I was to ever like, and I met him once, but I think what I would say to him now is I would meet him and then I would shake his hand and I would lean in and I say, I want you to know, death will be victorious. It does. I don't care how fast you go into space. I don't care how far you run. Death will find you, as he finds all of us.
John Stewart, thank you so much. And thank you for everybody for making this festival possible. And thank you to everybody who put it together.
Thank you. And thank you for the free subscription. Is that what
I get? Yeah, that's coming your way. John Stewart at the New Yorker Festival. His new show is called The Problem with John Stewart, and it can be found on Apple TV+. Up next, Daniel Craig talks about his final turn as James Bond. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Daniel Craig made his career as an actor first in the theater and in British indie films. And when he showed up in Hollywood, he was usually in smaller roles, often as a villain. So in 2005, Daniel Craig seemed as surprised as anyone to find himself cast as the original super spy, Ian Fleming's James Bond.
I'm looking most forward to actually starting, getting on with it, and being intimidated just by just about everything.
Are you looking forward to becoming a legend?
Oh, I don't know about that.
Why would I betray you?
15 years later comes No Time to Die, Daniel Craig's fifth and final appearance as Bond. Critics said he revitalized the franchise, presenting a more complex, morally compromised Bond suited to our times. And yet, Daniel Craig hasn't always been thrilled with the life of a blockbuster action hero. He's gone back to the theater whenever he could. And as he takes off Bond's tuxedo now, he's preparing to play Macbeth on Broadway. You know, I remember seeing you as Iago in a production, a terrific production of Othello. And I had to wonder what the different, radically different challenges of playing Iago in a relatively small room, playing Shakespeare, in the course of 2.5 hours or whatever, however long Othello takes to put on a given night, as opposed to these sprawling, epic, comic, serious action feats. It just has to be incredibly radical, much more radical than playing violin in the London Symphony and then playing in a rock band. It just seems so disconnected. How are they connected? How not?
Both of which I wish I could do. yes. I mean, listen, on a purely acting level, when you're doing it, there's little difference because you're trying to aim for some truth. You're trying to aim for some, to ground things in reality. But of course, doing a play and doing it night after night, there's a sort of, I suppose there's a purity to it. It's like, you know, it's like a firework. You know, you sort of light the blue touch paper and when you do a play and you're off. And with a movie, you know, you stop and you start and you go back and you kind of consider and you can do this and you can do that. But I don't try and differentiate between the two because I think that they're, you know, they both require the same muscles.
They do.
They do, yeah. I mean, there's a lot more, you know, chat.
In Shakespeare. Can you tell me about one day of shooting that is illustrative of what it's like to play James Bond?
I remember there was a sequence at the beginning of Quantum of Solace, which was a roof chase. It involved me running into a room, looking out of a window, mm-hmm. seeing a bus two stories down and leaping out of the window. And I was on a jerk harness, and the bus, I stop above the bus, but the bus goes under me, you know? So there's a lot of moving parts going on. And you can't really rehearse that until you're in the right situation. It was a real street in Siena. It was all of these things. And I'd done jumps, so I knew the jerk, how it worked and how it felt and, you know, the jerk of it, because it's called a jerk harness and it jerks you. But I remember standing there, and it was a second unit shot, and I didn't know any of the crew. And I was sort of introducing myself, but nervously introducing myself, because I was really nervous and I was with somebody. And I kind of felt very alone. I felt, my God, what am I doing? This is crazy. I'm leaping out of a window into the path of an oncoming bus. And it was a moment, that moment, when I suddenly went, but hey, I'm leaping out of a window in the path of an oncoming bus. Let's do it. It's like, and I kind of suddenly just, you know, I did it. I mean, we did it twice, I think. And, you know, and I just, it was a kind of moment. It was, the moment was so big, and I realized that what I was doing was so big and so out of my comfort zone and like nothing I'd ever done before in my life and will do since. I just had to kind of embrace it and just sort of go, okay, try and look good while you're doing it. That's a kind of, that's the note, you know, attempt to look good while you're doing it.
What is the injury report as your Bond career has come to a sad close? What does the hospital report look like for you?
Well, I'm a good friend. I'm a very good friend of a guy called Andy Cosgira, who is my surgeon at John Hopkins. It's John Hopkins, who I've become very close to.
You've kept him in business.
I've kept him very busy over the years, and he's as of a couple of surgeons, another one in London, who James Calder, who's looked at. I broke my ankle on this last one, and he patched me up on this one, so I have to give them a name check. I threw myself into these at the very beginning. I've been a massive fan since a child of Buster Keaton and Harold Lloyd, and for me, I used to watch those movies on a Saturday morning. They play on the television sort of one after the other. So from about 7 o'clock in the morning on British television. Mm. And all I remember is thinking, it's them. It's really them. It's that's their faces. They're there. And when I got involved with this, I thought, at least for some of this movie, it's got to be me. And I know we can face replace, and I know there's ways of faking it. And I know there's, and I had amazing stunt doubles who did crazy stuff for me. But at a certain point in the movie, I wanted the audience to go, oh, shit, it's him.
Yeah.
And that's where I started. Yeah. So I wanted to end that way. And after Spectre, I broke my leg very badly. And I was very, it was stressful on myself emotionally, but also just physically stressful. I could have gone two ways. I could have stopped the movie, had surgery. We could have shut down for 9 months and I could have come back again. Or I could carry on and we could, you know, risk me collapsing on my knee. And at the end of that, I thought, well, I can't do this anymore. I can't, because if I can't do the physical stuff, at least to a certain level, what's the point? I started off like that, so why would I? So I wanted to give up. I really wanted to give up. And a couple of years of healing, and I was mad enough to go back.
Well, did you ever think to yourself, enough of this shit? I only get one body.
Many, many, many times. But, you know, there were too many good things going on. There were too many amazing, you know, it's very, very, very rare air making a Bond movie. The privilege of getting to do that, anybody getting to do that, but for me to get to do that in five movies is so... I can't actually properly take it in. I mean, if you ask me to try and unpick it, what it means, I couldn't do it.
But do you feel more sanguine about it now? I mean, there maybe it was the press was not representing it properly or not. But here and there, one would get a report, and it seemed Daniel Craig's getting a little grumpy about Bond and maybe breaking his leg every so often, and he's had enough and. Let's go to Macbeth or something.
You know, I kind of had this comment. I did this comment where I said I'd rather slash my wrists, and it became a big deal. And
that was one hint, yeah.
That was one hint, yeah. was that? And I remember being asked, "Do you want to redo the interview?" And I was like, oh, "No, that's how I feel." And that was probably a mistake, but hey ho. What pissed me off so much was the fact that I thought I couldn't do them again, and do them to that level. And that was what got me. And I was like, you know, and there were times when the movies were a struggle. We had, you know, Quantum, we had a writer's strike, we had an actor's strike, possibly, we had no, you know, we had half a script, we didn't have it, you know, and I was trying to rewrite a script, which is not a good thing, and all of the, you know, all of these things. And those pressures just felt like, God, is this the way it has to be? Does it have to be this much of a struggle? But things work themselves out. I mean, I just wore my heart on my sleeve, and I think I could have been a bit more, I definitely could have been a little bit more, what's the word? Delicate about what I was saying, what I thought
diplomatic,
about things.
Yes. But did it indicate in yourself that you feared in some way that the bondness of your career might overcome or overwhelm the rest of it, despite its rewards, despite its fun, despite its remuneration?
Yeah, I think I definitely felt that at the beginning. And listen, I went in with open eyes. I knew, you know, I mean, I weighed it up. But I think for a while I thought, oh God, is this going to be, what am I doing to myself here? Am I destroying something as opposed to, but that just got better and better. And I think, listen, lots of things happened to me personally, and I just got softer about everything. I started to enjoy it. I started to look at it in a way that for what it is, that it's an incredible experience. And also, again, just to go back to the people that work, I get the chance to work with. I can't be pissed off about that.
Now, this looks very much, this is your swan song as James Bond. And you've been quoted as saying, when asked 10 million times, you know, who's going to be next and all that, that you don't give, well, you know what you don't give. But you also care about this franchise.
There's a nicer way. It's not my problem, which is a nicer way of saying it.
Yeah, fair enough. But you seem to care a lot about both the past of this franchise and its quality. What would you like to see in it as a fan, as a moviegoer? How do you think it'll develop?
Well, first off, I'll be front and center when the next one happens. I mean, I'll be on the front row with my popcorn and a big drink. I mean, because I mean, I love Bond movies, so I'll be happy to be there. I tried to leave it in a good place, and I had a deal with Barbara to get to this point.
Barbara Broccoli, the producer.
A verbal deal. but it's always where this was the direction I always wanted to take it.
What was the deal exactly?
Well, without kind of, you know, ruining the movie, I can't really, but it was just, if I do four of these movies, which was my deal, would you let me end it the way I want to end it? And she said, yes. I wanted to push it as far as I could push it. And that's what I would hope would happen. I've never tried to steer away or hide from the fact that Bond is who he is. I've always just tried to bring everything up to him so that, like specifically for the female characters, that they're as complicated and as difficult and as interesting as he is. But that's for selfish reasons. I hope that the movies expand in that way, that they represent and they become a greater reflection of society. That's what we've tried to do. And nobody should be constrained. Listen, with anything, there's a few rules in Bond, and I think those rules are good. I think they're interesting, and I think people want them, and I think that's why people go and see a Bond movie. But if you get those right, then it's open season as far as I'm concerned. I mean, I've tried to show a Bond that hurts, that feels, that, you know, doesn't get up again so easily when they're knocked down, and I think it's possible to absolutely go anywhere you want to do.
Daniel Craig, thank you so much. And I hope to be seeing you in the theater very soon with almost anything.
Great. That's wonderful. Thank you. Thank you so much. It's so lovely to talk to you.
Daniel Craig, his last movie is James Bond, No Time to Die, is in theaters now. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Back in a moment. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. The movie Hester Street came out in 1975, but it was filmed in black and white, set in the 19th century with dialogue in Yiddish, to accurately reflect its setting in the Lower East Side of Manhattan. A restored version of the film is in select theaters now, and it's going to be available for streaming soon. Hester Street was directed by Joan Micklin Silver, and Carol Kane played the role of Gittel, the naive young immigrant from Russia.
To have a son, a man must have a wife.
A wife you can get.
The one that I would ask. What if she would say no?
What if she would say yes?
Mrs., what are you doing?
I'm saying yes.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Carol Kane was nominated for an Oscar for that role, but she's far more familiar to us as a character actor, as a comic. This is a woman who could steal a scene with her eyes closed, and she's been doing that in shows from Taxi, Cheers, and Seinfeld, to a starring role in The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt. Carol Kane sat down with The New Yorker's Michael Shulman, who covers entertainment for the magazine.
I first want to tell you that my sister and I grew up obsessed with Scrooged, and we would quote your lines to each other as the ghost of Christmas Present, and we were just completely enamored
Thank
of you.
That was a great part I had.
You beating up Bill Murray is comic gold.
Well, I'll tell you, it was awfully fun, although I don't know if it was so fun for Bill.
Why did you do that?
Sometimes you have to slap them in the face just to get their attention.
Fine. Slap me in the face. But you kicked me in the wall.
It's time to begin our journey. Now.
I always think about you, Carol, as the quintessential comedic character actress. I was wondering, when you were starting out as an actress, is that how you thought of yourself? Or did you have some other plan in mind for your career?
Well, that's not how it was when I started out. You know, I started out as a dramatic actress. My first movie was with Mike Nichols directing and Jack Nicholson. And
Carnal Knowledge.
That's right. And then The Last Detail, which was also a drama with the great Hal Ashby and again Jack. Then I starred in a Canadian movie named Wedding in White, which was very dramatic and tragic, based on a true story, and then Hester Street, which was a drama. My first comedic role was with Gene Wilder in The World's Greatest Lover. I had never done anything comedic, so that was a complete surprise.
You know, Hester Street seems to be like such an unlikely movie to exist at all. You know, it's a black and white movie made in the 1970s. It's also directed by a woman, Joan Micklin Silver, which was extremely rare, even in the, you know, fabled New Hollywood of the 1970s.
Yeah.
Your part is mostly in Yiddish. Can you tell me a little bit about how you learned to do that? Did you know Yiddish before that at all? Did you grow up with relatives speaking Yiddish?
I did not,
Yiddish?
Because my grandparents came from Russia and Austria. My grandmother believed that she was American, and she clung to that and basically refused to speak Yiddish to me at all. So I really learned it by repetition with this teacher and actor from the Yiddish theater, and I just worked really hard.
Well, it sounds like your grandmother was very different from the character you play, Gittel, because she embraced, you know, assimilation into America. While Gittel really resists it throughout the whole movie. She doesn't want to change. She doesn't want to stop wearing her her traditional wig.
Her shidel.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, so much of the movie is, it's really a window into the question of Jewish assimilation. You know, that's been a conflict that really has played out through a lot of American Jewish life. I was wondering if that resonated with you and your experience growing up.
We were not religious, my immediate family, my father and mother. And so we barely ever went to temple or anything. And I have some real regrets about that. I wish I was more learned, you know, about the path of the Jews and the religion, the Torah. I kind of wish there had been more tradition, although I don't place blame on my parents for not having more tradition. I think some people rebelled against tradition in order to be more in the modern world, I guess, and be less separate, maybe. You know, and now I'm, as you may or may not know, I'm part of a show called Hunters on Amazon Prime. That show is all about hunting Nazis that live in America in the 1970s, which is all based on the truth. But when I watch what I watch to learn about that period, it's so, you know, unimaginable what happened, that I can certainly understand that many Jews would want to back off from the intensity of the religion and what happened and be in a more neutral position in society.
Mm-hmm.
To some degree, you could say self-protective and wise because, you know, they didn't want to be targeted again.
Right. I think when you kept saying tradition over and over again, it occurred to me that Hester Street could kind of be seen as a sequel to Fiddler on the Roof. Like, this is what happened to all those people when they come to America and have to figure out, can they still hold on to their traditions?
You know, that's so interesting. No one's ever mentioned that before, but I think that you're right. Could be.
This was just an incredible year at the Oscars. It was the year of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and Nashville and Jaws and Dog Day Afternoon, which you're also in as one of the hostages.
Louise Fletcher is the one who won for One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Yeah. It was just an incredible year of great movies. What do you remember about going to the Oscars that year?
It's just so crazy to find myself at the Academy Awards. And Theoni Aldridge, the great costume designer who's no longer with us, she designed me a dress for free.
I was actually going to ask you about your Oscar look because it is incredible. Anyone listening to this needs to Google Carol Kane Oscars and see your whole look. You had this incredible kind of nimbus of hair with flowers in it and kind of gothy makeup.
I always had that makeup because it was the silent movie stars wore that makeup. And that's the period that I was in love with, you know, it just seemed normal to me.
So you were like modeling yourself on Mary Pickford or something with that big hair.
Of, yeah.
I can see that. Yeah.
And you know, my biggest regret was that I didn't win for Max Birkin. I mean, I have to be honest, I would have liked to win for me too, but for Max and, you know, when you get nominated, and then I was at the Beverly Hills Hotel, but I was collecting unemployment while staying at the Beverly Hills Hotel doing the publicity. I get hundreds of interviews and people send you flowers and the phone rings off the hook nonstop and move. It's like a real flurry, you know. And then the next morning, having not won, I think I literally picked up the phone to see if it was working or not, because the silence was so conspicuous. Nobody called, no more flowers, no more nothing. And then the phone rings and it's Jack Nicholson.
And he had just won for One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Mm-hmm. And he called me the next morning and he calls me Whitey and he said, Whitey, I'm going to pick you up and take you to lunch. And he and Angelica, who they were a couple at the time, They came and picked me up and they took me to El Cholo's Mexican restaurant, you know, and we had lunch. And that was such a saving grace for me. But he knew what that morning was like, you know, because he'd had that morning. So he knew what it was like to feel sort of abandoned rather abruptly.
Right. Well, so you mentioned before how your comedic career really came after this movie. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about how that happened, because you're nominated for this really dramatic role in Yiddish. And then your career really took a different turn of being this madcap comic character actress.
It's a turn that has offered me a lot of happiness and a lot of sadness. So after being nominated, I did not work for a solid year. The phone stayed dead. Nothing came my way.
Wow.
I think maybe because the role had been so specific and there were no other roles like that. And there is that thing about typecasting, which you're talking about when you say that people think of me as comedic character woman. So I didn't work and I didn't work. And then about a year later, I got a phone call out of the clear blue sky from Gene Wilder, who offered me this role in The World's Greatest Lover of the leading lady, you know, just offered it to me. And it was a comedy. And he saw something in the performance of Gittle that he felt would be right for Annie, the character I played in The World's Greatest Lover.
What time is your screen test tomorrow?
4:30.
What?
4:30. Oh, no.
Oh, darling, it's nothing.
1, 2, 3.
It's nothing. It'll go away. You're just a little bit. You're nervous.
I'm not nervous. You're the one who got me upset.
You better just drop the subject.
Don't count what I say and say can't tell me.
We just shouldn't say that word anymore.
What word?
Screen test.
Why not?
And then I got offered the role in Taxi, which was just a guest star episode type of thing. Mm-hmm. And in those days, people that did movies didn't do TV, or if they did, it meant they had taken a step down, you know. But I knew that Jack Gilford had appeared in Taxi, and I loved and adored Jack Gilford as a person and his work, and I thought, well, Jack can do it, I can do it. And I took that role.
Oh, a job? Sit down. So, what do you do?
I'm working at the racetrack. They have a rake which goes around and cleans up after the horses, and they need people to sit on it to make it heavy. I'm the one in the middle.
I told you that America was the land of opportunity.
I love the comedy I've been able to do, but typecasting is limiting, you know, because that means you only play one type, you know, and it's limiting to only do comedy or only do drama. It's really nice to have the holistic version of work happening. It's strange, but, you know, not to quote the most quoted, but I must quote it because it's the most quotable. As John Lennon said, life is what happens to you while you're busy making other plans.
Well, Carol, thank you so much for talking with us. It's really great to chat with you. And I hope that people get out and get to see Hester Street.
Me too. Thank you, Michael.
The New Yorker's Michael Shulman speaking with Carol Kane. The restoration of Hester Street is in select theaters now, and look for it on streaming services soon. Now, before we go, I want to take a moment for some bittersweet news. Producer Rhiannon Corby has left the New Yorker Radio Hour for new adventures. Rhiannon joined our team before the show even went on the air, and over the years, her creativity, her sensitivity, and her persistence brought so many great stories to the show. I really am grateful to her and will all miss her. Best of luck, Rhiannon, and don't be a stranger. See you soon. I'm David Remnick. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado.
We had assistance this week from WNYC's Amy Pearl.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.